This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
We're here at Menards Bank Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste. Cereal. Coffee. Dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Grab your highlighters, grab your clinical thinking caps, because today we are tackling what is, I think, maybe the most essential pharmacology unit for anyone stepping onto a nursing unit.
I would agree.
We're talking about the body's self-defense systems and, you know, the really powerful high-stakes drugs we use to modulate them. We are diving deep into vaccines and immunomodulators.
And this is so much more than just memorizing drug names. The source material you've brought today really forms the backbone of clinical decision making.
Yeah.
We're going to be synthesizing everything from foundational immunology,
how the body protects itself.
Exactly. And then connecting that to detailed vaccine protocols, a really focused case study on herpes zoster, and then the incredibly complex world of agents like immunosuppressants and corticosteroids.
Our mission today is explicitly clinical. We're not just here to, you know, read from a textbook. We are here to apply judgment. We really need to master the indications and, maybe more importantly, the contraindications for these drugs and vaccines.
That's right.
Because nurses, you are the educators, you're the monitors, and you're often the first person to spot a life-threatening complication. So we're focusing on those core learning goals, describing immunity, applying clinical judgment, and providing rock-solid client education.
Exactly. When you're preparing to administer a vaccine or you're teaching a patient about, say, long-term management of a drug like prednisone, you have to understand the entire cascade of effects. I mean, from the molecular level right up to the systemic complications.
So let's start at the beginning. We need to understand the system we're trying to manage.
Let's do it.
Okay, let's unpack the body's ultimate defense system. It can feel pretty overwhelming to think about, but the sources break it down really logically into two main branches. It all starts with those immediate non-specific defenses.
That's the innate immune system. You could think of this as like the standing army. It's always there, always ready, and it responds in the exact same way no matter who the invader is. It's the body's first line of defense, and it's totally non-specific.
So it doesn't need to have seen a pathogen before to know it's bad news?
Not at all. And when we talk about this primary line, we're really discussing physical and chemical barriers that just block entry.
Okay, so what are some key examples the sources highlight there?
Well, the list is pretty long, but the biggest one is your skin. It's a physical, mostly impenetrable layer, but it goes deeper. You know, you have the cornea, the mucous membranes in your mouth and nose, the cilia in your respiratory tract. The
little hairs that sweep things out.
They literally sweep things out. And then you have the chemical defenses in the GI and GE tracts, like stomach acid or even the good bacteria that compete with and destroy invaders.
That makes perfect sense. It's like a filtration and barrier system. But what happens when a really sophisticated pathogen, say a virus or some virulent bacteria, gets past all of that?
Well, that's when the truly specific system kicks in,
mm-hmm.
What we call the adaptive immune cycle.
The intelligence agency.
That's a great way to put it. It's activated when the innate system is overwhelmed. And unlike the innate system, it is specific and it has memory. Its whole job is to produce these highly targeted antibodies against specific microbes or chemicals, which we call antigens.
So it learns the invader's signature, mounts a tailored response, and then remembers it for the future.
Yes, and that distinction, that difference between the immediate generic response and the delayed specific memory-driven response. That is exactly why vaccination works.
Right. Because if the adaptive system has memory, the next time it sees that invader, the response is going to be incredibly fast and overwhelming.
Precisely. And that leads us to the two main responses within the adaptive system: cell-mediated immunity and humoral immunity.
We don't need to get too deep into the weeds here, but what's the general idea?
Well, cell-mediated immunity usually involves T cells directly killing infected cells. Humoral immunity, on the other hand, relies on B cells and the production of those circulating antibodies. They really work together.
Okay, so let's move to how we classify protection in a clinical context. This is huge for nurses explaining things to patients. Active versus passive immunity.
Right, so active immunity is the long-term durable kind. It happens when your own body produces its own antibodies.
And you get that two ways.
Two ways. You can get a natural infection, you know, you get sick and recover, or the much safer route, through vaccination. Because your body's adaptive system created the memory cells, that protection is long-lasting. We're talking decades.
And then there's the other side of the coin, passive immunity. Immediate, but...
temporary. Passive immunity is basically a shortcut. You're getting antibodies transferred from an external source.
Like a mother passing IgG across the placenta to a fetus.
That's the perfect natural example.
Mm-hmm.
Or clinically, we might give an injection of immune globulin preformed antibodies to a patient who was just exposed to something serious like tetanus or hepatitis B.
So the protection is immediate, which is critical in that situation.
It's vital. But because the person's body didn't actually learn how to make the antibodies itself, the protection fades away as those transferred antibodies break down.
Okay, let's get into the key cellular components. We have to talk about the primary weapons, the antibodies. The sources list five key classes that you're going to see on patient charts.
Yep, we have IgM, IgG, IgA, IgE, and IgD. People often use the acronym GAMED to remember them.
But it's less about the letters and more about their function, right? That's what helps you interpret lab results.
100%.
So let's take that approach. Which one is the first responder?
That's IgM. You can think M for massive or M for immediate. It's the largest antibody, and it's the very first type produced when you're first exposed to an antigen.
Mm-hmm.
So if a patient has high IgM levels for something, it usually means they have a current or very recent primary infection.
Okay. And what about the long-term memory molecule, the one that crosses barriers?
That's IgG. G for gold standard, or maybe G for ghost of infections past. It's the most abundant antibody in your plasma. It's responsible for that long-term protection, and critically, it's the only one that can cross the placenta to give passive immunity to a newborn.
So if your patient has IgG but no IgM, that generally means they had the infection or the vaccine a while ago and they're protected.
Correct.
What about the others, IgA?
IgA handles mucosal defense. Think A for airways and alimentary tract. You find it in secretions, mucus, saliva, tears. It protects all those body surfaces.
And IgE is the one everyone knows from allergies.
Exactly. IgE is the allergy specialist. When it binds to mast cells, it triggers that release of histamine, which we'll definitely circle back to when we talk about antihistamines.
And IgD.
IgD is mostly found on the surface of B cells, kind of like a receptor. Its role in the whole system is a little less understood.
Now, looking at the structure of these antibodies, the sources really emphasize that antigen binding fragment. That's the key to their specificity, isn't it?
Absolutely. The unique Y shape of the antibody lets it precisely recognize and lock on to a specific antigen on a microbe. It's a lock and key mechanism, which is why an antibody against measles won't do a thing to protect you from tetanus.
And the final players here are the T cells, which drive that cell-mediated response.
Right, the T cell population. You've got your cytotoxic CD8 plus cells. Those are the killers that destroy infected host cells. You have regulatory cells that sort of calm everything down once the threat is gone. And then you have the helper CD4 plus cells, which are like the generals, orchestrating the whole adaptive response.
So this whole coordinated system is what we as nurses are trying to either enhance with vaccines or, as we'll see later, suppress with medications.
That's the whole game.
Now that we know how the body achieves active immunity on its own, let's explore how we use medicine to trigger that adaptive system on purpose and safely through vaccination.
The whole idea behind a vaccine is to introduce the antigen signature without introducing the disease itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a training exercise for your immune system so it can generate that long-term active immunity.
Okay, let's break down the three main classes of vaccines, starting with the ones that usually generate the strongest response, the live attenuated vaccines.
Right, so these use a weakened or attenuated version of the living pathogen. The virus or bacteria can still replicate a little bit inside you, but it's been engineered so it can't cause serious disease in someone with a healthy immune system.
And because it acts so much like a natural infection, it usually provides really durable immunity, often with fewer doses.
Correct. The classic examples from our sources are MMR, measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella for chickenpox. But this leads directly to their biggest clinical limitation.
Because the virus is still alive.
Because it's alive and replicating. So if your patient is severely immunocompromised, think a chemotherapy patient or someone with advanced HIV, that attenuated virus could potentially cause the full-blown disease. That is a huge nursing judgment call.
A critical one. Okay, next up are the inactivated vaccines.
These use pathogens that have been completely killed, usually with heat or chemicals. They're basically just antigen delivery systems. They carry all the right signatures for the immune system to learn from, but they can't replicate or cause disease.
Which makes them safe even for most immunocompromised patients.
Exactly. Examples here are things like Haemophilus influenza B or Hib hepatitis A and the inactivated poliovirus, IPV.
So since they don't replicate, what's the trade-off compared to the live vaccines?
They usually produce a less robust, less durable immune response. This means they almost always require multiple doses or boosters to get you to and keep you at a protective level of antibodies.
Which is why sticking to the schedule is so important for those.
It's absolutely critical.
And finally, the technology that has really changed the game recently, mRNA vaccines.
Right. Our source material points to the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine and also rotavirus here, though the tech is just exploding. The concept is pretty revolutionary. Instead of injecting the pathogen or even a piece of it, the mRNA vaccine gives your own cells instructions.
Like a blueprint.
A temporary blueprint. It tells your muscle cells near the injection site to manufacture a harmless little piece of the viral protein. Your immune system sees that protein, recognizes it as foreign, and starts building antibodies and memory T cells against it.
The beauty being that you're only getting the instructions, not the pathogen itself, living or dead. It's an incredibly targeted approach.
It is. Now let's shift to the clinical reality of giving these the contraindications to immunizations. For a nurse, this assessment you do right before the injection is non-negotiable.
We have to start with the big general rules. First is immunocompromised status. That's an absolute no-go for live attenuated vaccines like MMR and varicella.
Right. And even for inactivated vaccines, they might just be less effective in those patients.
The second general contraindication is a moderate to severe acute illness. So you have a patient with a high fever, maybe in respiratory distress.
We hold the vaccine. And the instinct is often to protect them, but clinically, we have to postpone it.
So why is that a mandatory hold? If they're already sick, why wait?
The main reason the sources cite is diagnostic confusion. Think about it. If the patient develops a fever or a headache in the 24 to 48 hours after the shot, you have no way of knowing if that's a normal vaccine side effect, a worsening of their current illness, or a totally new, maybe severe, adverse reaction. We wait until they're better to get a clean baseline.
That makes sense. Beyond those general rules, there are some really specific history questions you have to ask for certain vaccines. A severe allergic reaction to a prior dose is obvious, but what about the neurological ones?
You absolutely have to screen for a history of Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, after any previous vaccine. GBS is a rare but very serious autoimmune disorder where the immune system attacks your nerves.
And there's a potential link, however small.
It's rare, but documented. You also have to ask about the development of encephalopathy, a type of brain injury, within 7 days of a prior dose. If that happened, that specific vaccine is contraindicated for them forever.
And there's that unique, really serious pediatric contraindication for the oral rotavirus vaccine.
That's the history of intussusception. It's a condition where part of the intestine slides into another part, like a telescope collapsing. It's a surgical emergency.
And there's a known, though tiny, statistical link.
It's tiny, but it's there. So a prior history is an absolute contraindication. It just shows how important a meticulous history is, especially in pediatrics.
Lastly, we have to mention pregnancy. We know some vaccines, like the flu shot, are recommended, but many others aren't.
Right. Many are discouraged because of a theoretical risk to the fetus, especially the live vaccines. Our source material specifically calls out the HPV vaccine for discouraged use during pregnancy. It always comes down to balancing that theoretical risk against the known risk of the disease.
Okay, let's get practical. The vaccine schedules across the lifespan. Nurses are giving these shots, so we need to know the right time, the right place, and the right route.
Starting with birth to 6 years, this is by far the busiest time. The schedule's packed. RSV, hepatitis B, DTaP, IPV, HIB, MMR, varicella, HAV, PCV. It's a lot.
And the injection site in infants is all about safety and making sure the vaccine works right. So where do most of those IM shots go?
In infants and small children, almost always the vastus lateralis muscle. That's the big muscle on the side of the thigh.
Right there.
It's the largest muscle mass they have, so it minimizes the chance of hitting a major nerve or blood vessel, and it ensures the vaccine gets deposited deep in the muscle for the best immune response.
But then as the child gets older, we switch sites.
Yes. Once they have enough deltoid muscle mass, usually around 18 months to 2 years, but you have to assess individually, we switch to the deltoid, which is the preferred site for older kids and adults. And we can't forget the other routes. Oral for rotavirus, intranasal for the live flu vaccine, or subcutaneous for MMR.
Okay, moving on to age 7 through 18 years. Here, the focus shifts to boosters and specific adolescent vaccines.
Yep. The key scheduled ones here are the TDTI booster, HPV, and the meningococcal vaccines, MenACWY and MenB. These are often timed for starting middle school or going off to college. Plus, you have the yearly flu and COVID-19 vaccines.
And administration is almost all IM in the deltoid by this point.
Almost exclusively.
Now, for adults age 19 and older, this gets much more personalized based on age and risk factors.
You've still got your yearly influenza and COVID-19 and the standard TD booster every 10 years. But then you start layering things on. The HPV vaccine, for example, can be given up to age 45 if someone wasn't adequately immunized when they were younger.
And for our older adults, say over 65, the pneumococcal vaccine is absolutely essential to prevent severe pneumonia.
Exactly. And now we have the newer recommendation for the RSV vaccine for adults 60 and older. That's a standard part of the adult schedule now.
Oh.
We also have to counsel adults born after 1957 to get an MMR if they don't have proof of immunity.
Right, because measles is still a very real threat.
It is. And finally, some people need meningitis boosters if they have specific immune deficiencies or are traveling to high-risk areas. It really highlights how much clinical vigilance is needed to keep track of it all.
That brings us to our last big point on vaccines, reactions. When a nurse is educating a client, it is so important to clearly separate a common expected side effect from a rare, severe adverse effect.
This is where so much patient anxiety comes from. Side effects are just signs that the immune system is doing its job. They're common, they're expected, and they're often linked directly to the route of administration.
So, for instance, a parent calls and says their baby has diarrhea after the rotavirus vaccine, which is given by mouth. That's a common side effect.
Totally expected. Oral vaccines can cause some GI upset. The intranasal flu vaccine often causes a runny nose. And for pretty much all the IM or subcutaneous shots, you're going to see some localized soreness, swelling, and redness. These are all good signs.
The sources mention that these immune responses, the sore arm, maybe feeling a little tired, can be more obvious with live attenuated or combination vaccines.
They can be, yeah. Now, let's pivot to the much less frequent but far more critical adverse effects. These are the ones that require immediate clinical action.
The sources break this down by frequency. The most frequent but least severe are those local reactions. Less common are systemic reactions like a fever.
But the least frequent and by far the most severe is anaphylaxis. That is the generalized, immediate, life-threatening allergic reaction. It's why we have that mandatory observation period after every single vaccine.
So how does a nurse tell the difference between a really bad local reaction and a truly dangerous systemic one?
The clinical pearl here is to look for a systemic reaction. Are there generalized hives all over the body, swelling of the tongue or throat? Is the person having trouble breathing? Is their blood pressure dropping? That signals a severe allergic reaction that needs epinephrine now. A big red sore area just on the arm is usually just inflammation.
And we have to remember those specific severe risks mentioned for kids, seizures after DTaP and pneumococcal, or that risk of intussusception with rotavirus.
In every single case, the nurse's job is to document everything, educate the patient ahead of time, and be ready to act instantly if a severe event happens. Knowing what's normal versus what's an alarm bell is everything.
To really connect these ideas of declining immunity and the need for medication, let's turn to a high-yield clinical case study. Herpes zoster or shingles. You see this all the time.
Shingles is a perfect example of the immune system failing to keep a resident virus in check. The whole story starts with the varicella zoster virus, or VZV.
The same virus that causes chickenpox.
The very same. So you get chickenpox as a kid, you get better, and you think the virus is gone. But it's not.
It's just hiding. So where does it hide, and what makes it come back out?
VZV doesn't leave the body. It goes dormant or latent inside the sensory nerve cell bodies, specifically the dorsal root ganglia, which are nerve bundles right near the spinal cord. It can sit there for years, even decades, until your specific cell-mediated immunity, your T cells decline, usually because of age or some kind of immune suppression. When that happens, the virus reactivates and starts to travel.
And the path it takes is what causes that incredibly painful and very specific rash.
Exactly. The virus travels from that nerve, bundled down the axon of a single sensory nerve. This causes intense nerve inflammation or neuritis, which damages the neurons. That's why the absolute hallmark of shingles is a vesicular rash that follows the path of one dermatome and, this is critical, does not cross the midline of the body.
That dermatomal distribution is the classic nursing exam question for diagnosis. What about the symptom that often shows up even before the rash?
The pain. Because of that intense nerve inflammation, pain often starts several days before any blisters appear. Patients will describe it as burning, itching, a deep ache, or even electric shocks. Recognizing that early phase is key because it really impacts how well the treatment works.
Okay, so for our listeners, who is most at risk? This is vital for assessment.
The number one risk factor is age, specifically adults older than 50. But the risk just skyrockets in immunocompromised patients. We're talking people with HIV, cancer, transplant recipients, or anyone on chronic immunosuppressants, especially high-dose steroids.
So the nursing exam pearl is basically age plus immune suppression equals shingles risk.
That's the formula. But you can also see it triggered by things like chronic stress or a recent severe illness, anything that temporarily weakens that T-cell response.
All right, let's talk treatment. The focus is on acting fast to stop the virus and manage the pain. What's the golden window for starting antivirals?
Urgency is everything. Treatment has to start ASAP. The goal is within 72 hours of the rash appearing, or even better, within 72 hours of that initial pain starting. If you start after that 72-hour window, the drug is significantly less effective.
What are the three common antiviral options we use for VZV?
The main options are acyclovir, valacyclovir, and famciclovir. Acyclovir is the oldest and cheapest, but you have to take it up to 5 times a day.
Which is a huge issue for adherence.
A huge issue. That's where the other two are better. Valacyclovir and famciclovir are prodrugs, meaning they get converted into their active form in the body. They have much better oral bioavailability, so you dose them way less often, maybe just once or twice a day. They might cost more, but the better adherence often makes them the superior choice.
Antivirals stop the virus, but pain management is what the patient is really suffering with. How do nurses approach the different kinds of pain from shingles?
We treat it based on the type of pain. For mild pain, you know, regular NSAAs or acetaminophen can work. But the pain is often neuropathic. It's nerve pain. And that requires specific drug classes.
Which is where the anticonvulsants come in, even though the patient isn't having seizures.
Yes. For that shooting, burning, electrical pain, we use agents like gabapentin or pregabalin. They work by calming down those overactive sensory neurons that have been damaged by the virus.
And the major complication we're trying to prevent here is that long-term debilitating nerve pain.
That complication is called postherpetic neuralgia, or PHN. This is chronic nerve pain that just lingers long after the rash is gone. For established PHN, the sources recommend TCAs, tricyclic antidepressants, like amitriptyline. They have pain-relieving properties separate from their effect on mood. Opioids are really reserved only for very severe short-term pain.
And beyond the pills, what are some basic nursing interventions that are crucial here?
Topical care is huge. Cool compresses, calamine lotion to help with the itching, and keeping the lesions clean and dry. And the number one piece of education is do not scratch. That's how you get a secondary bacterial infection in those open sores.
And finally, prevention, the best intervention of all.
Absolutely. Prevention of shingles is done with the Shingrix vaccine. It's recommended for everyone age 50 and older, even if they've had chickenpox before.
Okay, we are shifting gears in a big way now. We've gone from teaching the body's immune system with vaccines to actively manipulating it with powerful drugs. This brings us to immunomodulation, starting with the drugs designed to turn the system down, immunosuppressants.
This class of drugs has two main, very high-stakes uses. First, they are critical for decreasing the risk of organ transplant rejection.
By stopping the body from attacking the new organ.
Exactly. And second, they're essential for reducing the symptoms and preventing the progression of severe autoimmune diseases, where the body is attacking itself, things like severe lupus or rheumatoid arthritis.
When you suppress the immune system, you are creating a state of vulnerability. What are the common adverse effects nurses have to watch for with all of these drugs?
The general profile is pretty clear. The patient is at a very high risk for infection. You have to screen them for latent infections like TB before you even start. Other common side effects are things like hypertension, high lipid levels, GI upset, and hyperglycemia.
But the real danger is in the specific toxicities of the different drug classes. Let's get into those high-yield specifics.
Right. You have to know the difference. First, you have the calcineurin inhibitors like cyclosporine and tacrolimus. These are workhorses in transplant medicine. Their signature adverse effect is nephrotoxicity.
Kidney damage.
Serious kidney damage. The nurse has to monitor kidney function like a hawk.
And the second major class?
The antimetabolites, like azathioprine or mycophenolate. These drugs mess with DNA synthesis, so they stop immune cells from proliferating. Their major side effect is bone marrow suppression.
So you see a drop in white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets.
All of the above. Leukopenia, anemia, thrombocytopenia.
This leads us right to the core nursing care. If these drugs are nephrotoxic and cause bone marrow suppression, what specific lab monitoring are we talking about?
Meticulous regular lab work. For the calcineurin inhibitors, nurses have to ensure they get accurate blood samples for drug trough levels.
To make sure the dose is just right.
Exactly. High enough to prevent rejection, but not so high that it's destroying the kidneys. And we're watching BUN and creatinine constantly. For the antimetabolites, we're focused on the CBC, the complete blood count, watching for any sign of that bone marrow suppression.
And we have to teach patients to look for subtle signs of infection.
You have to. A normal immune response, like a high fever or pus, might be totally blunted. A low-grade temperature could signal a life-threatening infection in these patients.
And we circle all the way back to vaccines. Live vaccines are generally contraindicated. This is a non-negotiable rule.
100%. Their immune system cannot safely handle a replicating live virus. It could cause the actual disease.
Okay, now let's flip the script to the other side of modulation. Immunostimulants. These are used to boost the body's resistance.
Right. These drugs are designed to ramp up the immune response. You see them used for immunodeficiency disorders. The sources mention HIV and AIDS, or as an add-on therapy in some cancers, or chronic viral infections to help strengthen the patient's own immunity.
And the side effect profile seems less severe than the suppressants.
It generally is, but they still have reactions. Common side effects often look like a normal immune response injection site reactions, flu-like symptoms like fever, chills, body aches. And you can see hypersensitivity reactions, so you still have to monitor carefully.
All right, if you are going into nursing, you absolutely have to master this next class of drugs. Corticosteroids, especially prednisone, they are everywhere. They're high reward because they work incredibly well, but the high-risk profile demands expert clinical judgment.
Corticosteroids are synthetic versions of cortisol, which is a hormone your adrenal glands make naturally. They're classified into glucocorticoids, like prednisone and mineralocorticoids.
Let's get into the mechanism of action for prednisone. It's not actually active on its own, is it?
No, it's a prodrug. It's well absorbed when you take it orally, but it has to be metabolized by the liver into its active form, which is called prednisolone. Once it's active, it has two primary powerful effects all over the body.
What are those two effects?
One, it is a potent anti-inflammatory. It blocks the production of key inflammatory chemicals like prostaglandins and cytokines. And two, it's a powerful immunosuppressant. It decreases the activity and the number of lymphocytes and suppresses T-cell activation.
So it slams the brakes on inflammation in the immune system at the same time. What else does it do to the body's overall chemistry?
Because cortisol is a master regulator, these drugs affect almost every system. They impact your blood cells, your mood and sleep, your electrolyte balance leading to water and sodium retention, and they have a profound effect on protein and carbohydrate metabolism. They raise your blood sugar.
So the indications are incredibly broad. You see them for everything from asthma and COPD to autoimmune diseases and preventing transplant rejection.
Exactly. Anytime you need to suppress inflammation or the immune system, they are a go-to option.
Given that power, the list of contraindications is huge. This is a critical nursing assessment.
The absolute contraindications have to be memorized. You're talking about a pre-existing systemic fungal infection. The steroid would let the fungus run wild. Also, cerebral malaria, herpes, simplex keratitis, a viral infection of the eye, and any uncontrolled infection like chickenpox or shingles.
And the metabolic contraindications are also major red flags.
Yes. Absolute no-goes include uncontrolled diabetes, or severe hyperglycemia, severe osteoporosis because steroids just chew up bone, and uncontrolled hypertension.
We also have those specific rote-based contraindications.
Right. You can't give an IM injection of a steroid to someone with ITP. an autoimmune platelet disorder because of the massive risk of bleeding. And you can't put topical steroids on a skin infection.
Then there are the relative contraindications where you have to be really careful.
Things like congestive heart failure because of the fluid retention or peptic ulcer disease. The risk-benefit analysis has to be really meticulous.
Okay, let's talk about the consequences of using this drug, the side effects and the adverse effects. We need to separate what happens with short-term use from the really devastating effects of long-term therapy.
Short-term, common side effects include an almost immediate rise in blood glucose, fluid retention and swelling, weight gain, indigestion, and mood disturbances, like feeling restless or having trouble sleeping.
But the adverse effects of chronic steroid use, that's where we see the really serious problem.
Yeah, these are linked to having that constant high level of steroid activity. The source material has a great visual of what we call the Cushingoid features.
Let's describe those for our listeners. What does that look like?
Cushingoid features come from protein breakdown and fat redistribution. You get that characteristic rounded face, the moon facies, you get a fat pad on the upper back, the buffalo hump, and central obesity with really thin arms and legs.
And the skin changes too.
Yes. The high cortisol levels break down collagen, leading to thin, fragile skin, easy bruising, and those classic purple stria or stretch marks.
And beyond how it looks, what are the irreversible long-term risks?
Long-term use causes severe bone loss, osteoporosis. It can cause diabetes mellitus or make existing diabetes much worse, muscle wasting, psychiatric problems like hypomania or even psychosis, and eye problems like glaucoma and cataracts.
We also have to mention the pediatric concern.
We do. Corticosteroids can cause growth suppression in children and adolescents. That's a huge consideration when you're planning long-term therapy for something like juvenile arthritis.
Now for what might be the single most critical piece of nursing knowledge for managing chronic steroids, the endocrine effects and the tapering mandate. This is where stopping the drug abruptly can literally kill the patient.
This is non-negotiable. When you give someone steroids from an outside source, their body's own production loop, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal or HPA axis, it senses all that cortisol and it just shuts down. The adrenal glands stop making their own.
It's like you've turned off the body's natural stress hormone factory.
Exactly. And if you stop the drug cold turkey, that HPA axis can't just reboot instantly. The patient suddenly has no cortisol, and they crash into acute adrenal insufficiency. We're talking severe fatigue, shock, hypotension, and it can be fatal.
So the critical nursing action is, do not stop abruptly. The dose has to be tapered down, sometimes over weeks or even months, to give that HPA axis time to wake back up.
A few other key nursing points. Always monitor for subtle signs of infection. A patient on prednisone can have raging pneumonia, but only a very low-grade fever because the drug masks the inflammation. Check blood glucose regularly, even in non-diabetics.
And the timing of the dose matters?
Yes. Give it with food to reduce GI irritation and give it in the morning. That mimics the body's natural cortisol rhythm and can help with sleep disturbances.
Let's finish up with a very common class of drugs that targets that acute inflammatory cascade, antihistamines. Specifically, the H1 blockers, like diphenhydramine, which everyone knows as Benadryl.
Right. Histamine is a key chemical released during allergic reactions. H1 antihistamines work by just binding to and blocking the H1 receptors on cells, which stops histamine from activating them and reduces the symptoms of an allergic response.
The major clinical difference is between the two generations of these drugs, and that difference really determines the whole side effect profile.
That distinction is all about the blood-brain barrier. First-generation agents like diphenhydramine and chlorpheniramine, they're lipophilic. They easily cross the blood-brain barrier. And when they block H1 receptors in the brain, the main side effect you get is drowsiness and sedation.
And the second-generation agents fixed that problem.
They did. Second-generation agents like loratadine, Claritin, and cetirizine, Zyrtec, are designed so they don't readily cross the blood-brain barrier. They focus their action out in the periphery, so you get significantly fewer CNS effects. It makes them much better for people who need to be awake and alert during the day.
The main reason to use them is for allergic responses. Hay fever, hives, atopic dermatitis. But even these common over-the-counter drugs have some serious cautions.
They do. There's a potential for QTC prolongation, which is an electrical instability in the heart that can lead to dangerous arrhythmias. You have to be really cautious in patients with impaired kidney or liver function.
And those anticholinergic properties of the first-generation drugs are a real problem in certain patients, especially the elderly.
Absolutely. Yeah. The first-gen agents give you those classic anticholinergic symptoms. dry mouth, dizziness, urinary retention, blurred vision. That makes them dangerous for anyone with pre-existing urinary retention and a large prostate or a narrow-angle glaucoma.
And they can cause significant confusion and increase the risk of falls in older adults.
Yes. The side effects list for the first generation is pretty long. At higher doses, you can see really severe adverse effects like clumsiness, confusion, even delirium.
We have covered a huge and truly critical area of pharmacology today. We started with the body's most basic defenses and went all the way to the complexity of pharmacologically manipulating the immune system.
I think for future nurses, this deep dive really shows that every single immunization, every dose of an immunomodulator, it requires this careful risk-benefit analysis that's rooted in your clinical judgment. Mastering contraindications is not an academic exercise. It is the foundation of patient safety.
Absolutely. Recognizing a systemic vaccine reaction, knowing why a 3 times a day antiviral regimen is going to fail because of adherence, understanding the need for trough levels, and crucially, knowing that mandatory tapering rule for steroids, these are the daily realities you are going to face. This is what separates a good nurse from a great one.
So let's end with a final provocative thought that ties a few of these concepts together.
Mm-hmm.
We stress that absolute rule, live vaccines are generally contraindicated for patients on long-term immunosuppressants.
Okay, that's clear. No MMR for a patient on chronic high-dose prednisone.
Right. But what if you have a patient who is newly diagnosed with a severe autoimmune disease? They need to start that high-dose long-term steroid therapy very soon, but their vaccination record shows they're missing an MMR booster.
Uh-oh.
How would a nurse apply this principle to plan the optimal timing of that immunization? How do you ensure they get maximum protection without the risk of the live vaccine causing disease after their immune system is suppressed?
That's a true clinical dilemma. You're stuck between the need for immunity and the upcoming suppression.
It requires real strategic thinking. Do you advocate for getting serology testing to see if they have immunity before the steroids start? If they don't, is there a narrow window, maybe 2 weeks, where you can safely give that live vaccine before the immunosuppressant is started, giving their system just enough time to build protective antibodies before the drug shuts the whole response down? That decision, that timing, that is the level of clinical thinking this material demands. Something to mull over as you get ready for your clinicals.